Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Clones, what's going on? How you living? Welcome to the Daily Jungle. We had a fun Wednesday show. Kyrie Irving brought the Cavs back from 16 down and ripped game four from the Celtics. Plus, LeBron blew the greatest outlet pass ever, blowing that tomahawk dunk after Kevin Love hit him with an absolute dime. We covered all of that. And Raj went cool dad as the NFL brings back end zone celebrations. We also had three nice interviews. Defending Indy 500 champ Alexander Rossi, Detroit Tigers third baseman Nick Cassianos, and Rays shortstop Tim Beckham. All three guys brought it. And you get my take on Tom Cruise's announcement that Top Gun 2 is coming. Alvin, do your thing. Let's talk about that game last night. Starting with this. Move over King. Kyrie has got this. Just when you think, I mean, it seemed absurd, but just when you think maybe the Celtics are really better without Isaiah Thomas. I mean, just think about it for a minute. I mean, sure, it sounds like the most lava take ever. Until you remember that they did come from 21 down to win Game 3 a couple of nights earlier. And then they chased that by jumping on the Cavs last night and building a 16-point lead. I mean, maybe. Maybe it's true. Maybe they are better without their 5'9" point guard. Maybe he is something of a defensive liability. Maybe the ball does move better when Isaiah Thomas is not on the floor. Maybe they're a tougher matchup and tougher to defend with him on the bench. Maybe the Celtics were actually going to tie this series without Thomas, send it back to Boston, and re-rip the home court. And maybe they were going to shock the world with their heart and soul in streets, right? Yeah, maybe I'm Bill Russell. Fool's gold. You know what happened was they got temporary adrenaline. They got that temporary adrenaline surge that teams sometimes get when their star player goes down or leaves the game. And then everybody else knows they've got to step their game up. You couple that with the Cavaliers losing interest momentarily and taking their foot off the gas and Boston playing with a sense of desperation and the Celtics steal game three. As far as last night, sure, they got off to a great start. And they had this unbelievable opportunity when LeBron went to the bench in the first half with a fourth foul. A golden opportunity that they could not take advantage of because, back on point, Kyrie stepped up and he ended them single-handedly. The Celtics don't have a single guy that can stay in front of Kyrie. Truth is, when Uncle Drew gets it going and he's feeling it the way he was last night, there's not a guy in the NBA who can check him. He's unguardable. You can count on one hand the number of guys in that league who could take over a game like that. And then even fewer who can do it on that big of a stage. My man went to work. And he didn't put down that blowtorch until he ran and shot the Celtics right out of that gym. He went into full-scale hero mode, scoring 36 of his 42 after LeBron went to the bench. Dude was snapping ankles and snatching souls and making it all look so easy.
Bounce pass to Irving. Irving to the basket. Got hit. He lays it up and in.
That's Irving right side. Jab steps. Launches a three to Irving.
He knocks it down. Kyrie.
LeBron getting a little help from his friends.
Irving goes to work at a half step on Bradley to the basket. He goes. Got foul. Puts it up. And puts it in. And Kyrie Irving has a chance for the three-point play. Oh, my. Irving has 10 to shoot. He's guarded by Rozier. Makes a move. Goes down the lane. Lays it up. He puts it. Angles got it in. He scores. Irving now is 13 of 19 from the field. Irving, watched by Rozier. Three left. Step back, long three. He nails it.
Cavs Radio. LeBron might be the best player in the world, but on a night like that, Kyrie is there to remind you he's not that far behind. And if LeBron is going to no-show like he did in Game 3, or go to the bench with foul trouble like he did last night, Kyrie is there to remind you that's no problem at all. There to tell him, we got you, King. Take game five off if you want, because we've got that too, King. Because even without him, there is not a team in that league other than Golden State that can stay with the Cavs. And without Isaiah Thomas, the Celtics have absolutely no chance in that series. And Kyrie, more than anybody else, knows that wasting time on an outclassed Celtics squad with Golden State already at home, getting their rest, is the worst idea ever.
In the back of my mind, I was like, I'm saying to myself, they cannot tie up this series. They cannot. We cannot go to Boston 2-2 and then it becomes almost an even series.
He's right. So LeBron should have never been in position to pick up that fourth foul in the first half. Nor should Boston have had any look at ripping another one and sending it back home 2-2. But in the end, they didn't. Not on Kyrie's watch. Not even on a bum wheel. He knew better than to let Boston up and give them any reason to believe. Dude's a killer and a closer and a finisher. And now he and they have to go back to Boston, drive a stake through their heart, put them out of their misery, and put the rest of us out of our playoff misery and give us all what we want. The trilogy. One step closer. But for a moment there, it looked like they might go back to Boston, tied up at two games apiece until Kyrie took over. 1-800-636-8686. All right, one more thought about that game. As amazing as Kyrie was last night, my favorite moment of that night had to be LeBron butchering that alleged tomahawk dunk. And that was history right there. I mean, sure, that can happen to anybody. Kobe, Mike, and yes, even LeBron. But not after Kevin Love made literally the greatest outlet pass in the history of that sport. Literally. And that's no hyperbole there. I'm not saying that for effect. That literally was the finest outlet pass in the history of the world. Look, I understand that Kevin Love is a really, really skilled guy and that he can do a number of things that he has no business doing. But no one anywhere has any business making an outlet pass like that. And because he did, LeBron really had no business jacking it up by butchering that jam the way he did.
5 on the shot clock. Avery Bradley against Tristan Thompson. Pull up, 20-footer, short, rebound. Kevin Love and Horford.
Whoa.
Kevin Love comes up with it. Long lead for LeBron, and he misses the dunk. And that is the highlight you'll be seeing all day tomorrow. Avery Bradley fouled coming across half court.
Celtics radio. Nothing says old and tired like not getting up to finish that play. I mean, that was both hard to watch and hilarious at the same time. How is this guy going to shoot the Cavs past the Warriors when he can't even execute an uncontested dunk? An uncontested dunk coming off one of the greatest assists in league history. Get your rest, Pops. Or better yet, next time, let Kyrie leak out and let him handle it for you. Either that or get to the gym a couple hours early for Game 5 and work on throwing it down and finishing around the basket. Because while the world is willing to forgive one butchered slam from a legend like you, you will never get away with it doing it a second time. Especially seeing the reaction to it. That jam at that time would have given Cleveland the lead and torn the roof right off that barn. But instead of the roof being torn off in Cleveland, it was torn right off Twitter. Forget the comparisons to MJ. People were literally, well, practically comparing Bron to Kwame. That's how bad that was. The only thing missing from that was the terse exchange with a local radio reporter after it happened where LeBron says, "Man, you only come around here, Kenny, after I miss dunks."
For you, you said, you know, it was just your game. Couldn't get into a rhythm tonight. Is that what it was based on their defense or just not feeling it or what?
No, I was just pretty poor. I mean, what do you want me to say? Yeah. Seemed like you only answer. You only ask questions when we lose. It's a weird thing with you, Kenny. Always come around when we lose.
Well, I miss dunks.
Yeah, okay.
Hey, look, again, Bron, if anybody is allowed one of those, as awkward as it was, he's allowed one of those, and it can happen to anybody, including him. And sure, Twitter had its fun. But it won't be nearly as fun if it were to happen again. How do you waste the greatest outlet pass ever? Ever.
Whoa!
Clones, I need to talk to you about Ferguson. Ferguson helps facilities pros by supplying innovative and reliable products. But what Ferguson really offers are solutions. Ferguson has a dedicated team of facilities experts, and with nationwide coverage, we deliver directly to your facility right when you need them. Plus, Ferguson's broad inventory of maintenance, repair, and operations products, along with plumbing, HVAC, and appliances, sets Ferguson apart from traditional facility suppliers. So learn more about how Ferguson Facility Supply can help your facility at Ferguson.com today. That's Ferguson. Now it's back to our Daily Jungle. Alexander Rossi is my guest. You are the returning champ, so things were very different for you when you arrived at the Brickyard last year. So what's it like to come back as the winner of the Indy 500?
It's pretty cool. I mean, it's a lot more people are paying attention to what I'm doing. That's for sure. So I guess that's good and bad. As long as I'm doing a good job. Yeah, I mean, it's very special to be able to come back here. The Indianapolis Motor Speedway is a special place in and of itself. But to come back as the reigning winner and looking to defend that has been a pretty cool experience, and looking forward to the race this weekend.
All right, so go back to last year for a minute. You've said that when people see photos of you after that race, quote, they see the photos of me looking kind of spaced out, and they say, why don't you look more excited? You just won the Indy 500. What is your response when folks say that? What was going on?
Well, I mean, what a lot of people don't realize is the fact that for about 100 laps, I didn't think there was any potential to win because the strategy that we had adopted or were forced to change to was pretty aggressive. And there was a very good chance I was going to run out of gas before the end of the race. So I didn't kind of allow myself to believe that I'd have the potential to win. And from when I did, there was a very short period of time before the public saw me. So it was a pretty wide range of emotions that I went through in a very short period of time.
You graduated from high school early. You went to Europe to pursue a racing career. And then you came back last year and you went from starting Grand Prix races and being the only American to hold a Formula One super license to running at the Indy 500. And you did that in a really short period of time. So what was the learning and the preparation process like you in that buildup to the Indy 500 last year?
Oh, it was a massive learning curve. You know, I never raced on an oval before. It was all new. So I was very, very fortunate to be a part of Andretti Autosport and have a huge wealth of information to rely upon to get me up to speed. And having Michael as a team owner and Mario as a mentor, and then Marco and Ryan as teammates. I mean, it was just a huge wealth of information to kind of dig into. And Andretti Autosport has always been strong in the 500, so I was fortunate to have a good car out of the box, and I could just focus on learning and trying to improve each time I got in the car.
All right, so last thing, and this is kind of funny, there are some perceptions about you that are not necessarily accurate. For example, one of your fellow drivers, Joseph Newgarden, said that his favorite one is when people say you are not American, and then he added, quote, I want to grab people and tell them, dude, he's from Sacramento. What's your reaction when you hear people say that you're not American?
It's pretty frustrating because it's like it's amazing how people just assume things based on a name. It's like it just blows my mind. So I mean, I don't really know what else to do other than, you know, correct people and keep winning races and show that the American flag is on my car. But it's pretty frustrating. So that's about all I can say.
Other than say, dude, I'm from Sacramento. All right, so you win the
race.
I
mean, yeah, not even Sacramento, like even like a smaller town, like way more in the country in the foothills, and like we have two restaurants. And
I got you. I completely understand it. All right, you won the race once. It would be natural to feel like, all right, I've checked that box. Maybe I can relax a little bit. Is that the case, or having won it once, now that you have a taste, you want it even more now, a second time?
Oh, yeah, so much more. I mean, it's such an amazing experience that goes on for an entire year afterwards that you just – you don't want anyone else to have it, and opportunities present themselves that probably wouldn't have otherwise. And you definitely just want to be able to keep doing it and not let anyone else experience the kind of fruits that come with it.
The NFL is going to have end zone celebrations once again. Time to break out and start practicing the icky shuffle. Time to start working on your goalpost dunks. The NFL is going to allow celebrations back into the game. And that's not a bad thing, potentially. You can drive a stake right through that so-called no fun league. It's been a while, but remember how great it was back in the day when dudes could get loose in the end zone, when they could do whatever they wanted. Do you remember what it was like? I know Randy Moss does. Who will ever forget Randy Moss going pantomime moon landing on the Green Bay goalpost back in the day?
Moss! Randy Moss is here! For a touchdown.
Without even really being able to run as he shoots the moon to the fans here in Green Bay.
That is a disgusting act by Randy Moss.
A, quote, disgusting act by Randy Moss.
Is a disgusting act by Randy Moss.
Yeah, but an act nonetheless. At least it was something. Disgusting or otherwise. Instead of flagging guys for breaking a smile or even stride, bring that back. Bring back T.O.'s popcorn. Chad Ochocinco's future Hall of Fame gold blazer. Yeah, nice try with that, Chad. He deserves one of those about as much as I do at this point. How about Joe Horn's freaking burner phone?
Brooks with time, rifles, touchdown, Saints. Joe Horn, and he pulls up the protective coating. Uh-oh, there's a new one.
He got his own phone.
He hit his phone.
He had his phone stashed in the end zone.
All right, now remember, Terrell Owens, they passed a rule after the Sharpie came out, and it said you can't have anything on your body. Now, Monday morning in the commissioner's office, we're going to have a new rule regarding celebrations.
And I'll tell you right now, I don't like it. I think that does not show me sportsmanship.
Nope.
I really don't.
It
I think that
doesn't.
Is bad.
It's cheap.
And the officials now draw a flag. That's going to be unsportsmanlike conduct.
I'm glad.
And good for them.
I'm glad.
Get off my front porch. The only thing missing from that was a disgusting act. Him pulling that phone out of the goalpost pad. That was a disgusting act. And all of a sudden now, you've got the commissioner. And the commissioner is now allowing this to happen. Suddenly the guys who think the most out-of-touch dude ever, who has no idea what they're about or what the game is about, somehow is completely dialed in, at least as it relates to end zone celebrations.
The reality is, you know that the players want to celebrate. You know they want to exhibit their individuality and the excitement that they're feeling at that point in time. And they're very creative, as we all know. So that didn't surprise me. Several players have mentioned they didn't like the props. I mean, that wasn't unanimous. I think what was very, very strong consensus was the importance of keeping the standards up so that it reflected well on the players, it reflected well in the game, that we didn't do things that would be insulting to our fans, and I am confident the players are going to do that.
All right, so the biggest takeaway right there is make sure it's spontaneous. Don't be planting prop objects around the stadium to later pull out. Don't do anything to insult the fans. This is not that hard. It's not that big a deal. Let these guys celebrate. Let these guys show some emotion. Not that hard, not that big of a deal. But the line has to be drawn somewhere, apparently, because twerking is still illegal. How do I know? Because my man Roger tried to yuck it up with my main guy, Keegan Michael Key, on Twitter. He tweeted, "Don't get any ideas about pumps at Keegan M. Key. They're still not okay under the new policy. Hashtag football is family." Good one, Commish. He's referencing a skit from Comedy Central's Key & Peele, where three or more pelvic thrusts would in fact get you flagged.
Ransom takes the snap, drops back with good protection, and that's a completed pass to a very wide open Hingle McCrinkleberry, the rookie out of Penn State.
Nice grab by McCrinkleberry. You think he's happy?
Oh boy, he is loving it down there.
Oh, we got something of a shooting gallery going on.
Oh, yeah, look at that. Boy, that is something. And, wait, we got a flag there.
He got
is that for excessive celebration?
Yeah.
Well, see, and I'm not sure about that call.
I don't know, Bill. That was three pumps, and the rule book says you cannot have more than two.
Oh, my gosh, but look at the kid. He's pleading his case with the ref. Pleading his case.
Yeah, clearly three pumps.
Coach Johnson definitely not happy about this call.
Three pumps. Can't do it. Three pumps. Apparently too many. In the meantime, somebody should check in on the commissioner. What exactly has flipped him into cool dad mode? Are mom and dad getting a divorce? It's like Raj has been stuck in bad cop parent role in all these years and finally just said, screw it. You know, that divorced parent guilt syndrome. Now he's like, hey, do whatever you want, kids. Do whatever the hell you want. Yeah, whatever you want. It's all good. It's fine. Smoke him if you got him. Hell, bum me one if you got him. Either that or he's going classic commish. And he's just setting these dudes up, buttering these dudes up like suckas. He's going to give them an inch before eventually taking back the mile. You know, like, sure, you can have your celebrations. They're legal. But check the fine print. We're also expanding to an 18-game season. Hey, go ahead with your Sharpie, like T.O., or go Super Mario and slide down the goalposts like Antonio Brown. Do whatever you want. Do whatever you want. Show us your personality. Show us your emotion. Do what you want. We don't care. In fact, we love it all. Oh, by the way, we're expanding to Wednesday night games too. Bottom line, celebrations are good for the game, obviously. Last thing you want to do is legislate emotion out of the game. Try to turn every single guy into the same guy. and an occasional act of end zone baggery is still better than no act at all. A smart move by the commissioner to allow it, but it's now up to the players to execute it. Bring it, fellas. Be clever, be original, be entertaining. Just don't let us down. Because if you come with something tired or lame, I'll probably be the first one to ask the commissioner to put that ban on it all over again. Don't waste a good opportunity. You've got a chance to do something good with this. Be clever.
Is a disgusting act by Randy Moss.
Better that than something else. Nick Castellanos is our guest. Nick, it's good to have you on. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. Good to talk to you, Nick. All right, so the team dropped a tough one to Houston last night. Now you get them again this evening. How eager are you to get back out there and get things turned around after a tough loss like that?
Good. You know, the past two games in Houston, we really haven't been clicking too much at the plate, you know. So, but that's the beauty of baseball. We got a brand new game today, so we'll see what happens.
You know, when you look at your situation, I mean, you're currently going through a tough stretch, and even though you're young, you're already one of the established leaders in that clubhouse. So how do you go about dealing with a stretch that you're dealing with while at the same time manage to lead the rest of the guys when you know they're probably looking to you?
Thankfully, I don't have to take on that big of a role where I have to, you know, lead, because we have so many veterans, you know, to lean on. Even though this is, you know, my fourth year in the big leagues, we still have Miggy, who's got 13, Victor, who's got 13, Ver, who's got 11, Kinsler, who has 11, Upton, who has, you know, 10 plus. So there's a lot of wisdom in that clubhouse that we all lean on each other. And, you know, baseball is just one of those things that we're all kind of just going through like a little stretch here, but it's just temporary, you know.
Nick Castellanos joining us. The thing about baseball is it will test you in so many different ways. It is such a tough game, and it's such a grind. I mean, as an example, you were having a huge year last year, and then you suffered a broken hand after being hit by a pitch on August 6th. As a result, you missed the next 50 games. You were able to come back for the final five games, but how challenging is it to be having the kind of year that you were having and have it cut short because of being hit by a pitch, of all things?
It's no secret. It sucks, especially when your team was in kind of the playoff hunt, you know. But what are you going to do? You know, my hand was broken, so you could sit there and say, like, oh, what if, poor me, you know. But that's not going to do anybody any good. So the only thing I try to do is just to get healthy as quick as possible and come back, you know. And I was proud of myself that I was able to make it back for those five games.
And not only make it back, Nick, but I mean, it sounds like you actually got something positive out of it. I mean, to your point, it sucks. Nobody wants that to happen, but then it happens and you get something out of it. I've heard you talk about how you learn patience. You learn about sticking to a routine. You don't want to be there, but it is a game of patience. So did you pull something positive out of that? And if so, what was it?
Pretty much. Well, it was the first time in my career that I was ever hurt. So it was the first time that I physically couldn't play baseball. So, you know, a little bit, it was the first time I was a fan of the game instead of a player. And I know that doesn't really seem like a lot, but you can kind of lose perspective of the game when you're playing consistently. And then that was for the first time for 2 months that I was sitting in the dugout and watching. And you just learn to appreciate it. Well, me anyway. I learned to appreciate it a little bit more. And, you know, to kind of go through that obstacle kind of makes you a better person and a better athlete and a better professional when you come out of it.
Nick Castellanos joining us, third baseman for the Tigers. Now, team owner Mike Gilich passed away in February, and you were one of the players who spoke in a tribute to him. What kind of memories do you have of him?
Not very many. All the few that I do are very positive. You know, even though he was older and when he came into the clubhouse, he was always smiling. He was always in a good mood. Said hi to everybody. He was joking. I don't know if that was his character away from the baseball field, but when he was in the clubhouse, he was always making jokes, smiling, and very lighthearted. Just a phenomenal guy, really, all around, not just as an owner, but as a family man and pretty much everything he's done for the city of Detroit.
Sure. Nick Castellanos joining us. You know, you did a piece with Kevin Millar and MLB Network back in spring training where you showed him how you work off a batting tee. Of course, you're facing pitchers who throw high 90s. They have a ton of movement. So what kind of things do you get out of working off a tee against a ball that's not moving at all?
Pretty much. Me personally, when I'm struggling a little bit or whatever, I love to just go back off of the tee because, you know, it becomes more about you and your swing rather than, you know, hitting the baseball, really. You know, so you can kind of just get back to square one, slow everything down, go at your pace, you know, and the trick is to take that pace and put it in a game situation, you know. It's a lot easier said than done, but, you know, I for me anyway, a tee is a tool that I really like to use on a daily basis.
You know, Nick, watching Millar on that piece, you could tell how much he thinks of you. You and he, in fact, go way back to when he was with the Marlins and would hang out with Alex Fernandez, who coached you at the legendary powerhouse Archbishop McCarthy. What did you learn from Hernandez growing up? And do you have any memories of Millar from back in the day as well?
That's actually really funny you asked me that question because, you know, this is his last year, you know, working at that high school. So I was just asked to write a letter for him because they're going to give it to him at the end of the season. So I did this probably 30 minutes before we had this conversation. So I got a lot. He was my dad's really good friend. My dad also knew his wife when she was in diapers. So, I mean, he was really that guy that made it seem like being a Major League Baseball player was real, because I'd be hanging out at his house and playing with his son. And then, you know, he'd put both of us in the car and then off we go to, you know, Pro Player Stadium. And it was just normal. And, yeah, I got memories of Millar too. Millar, I remember he was younger. So, and I think he was he was pretty much only starting against lefties, and my dad was a lefty. So Alex had a cage in his backyard. And, you know, after school, my dad would pick me up. We'd drive the quarter mile, whatever it was, to Alex's house, and we'd just open up his back gate, go hit in the cage. And sometimes Millar would just be stumbling in and say, like, "Hey, Doc, like, I'm starting today. Let me get some swings." So he'd jump in. So he'd jump in the cage, and he'd take some swings off of my dad.
Yeah, how would he do?
Good, man. Millar's got a short swing, man. He's good. He was fun to watch play.
And Nick, what is it about some guys? Maybe he is one of these guys, maybe he's not, but some guys literally, you know the saying, they can literally roll out of the rack swinging the bat, right? It almost doesn't even matter. Is there something to that? Can some guys just do that? As hard as it is to hit a Major League Baseball, can some guys really just kind of fall out of the rack and hit the ball?
Well, I think the best ones can, because that's what comes most naturally to them. You know, do you think about riding a bike? No, but you just get on it and you do it. You know, when you see Miggy and you see, you know, Trout and you see Bonds and you see all these guys, you know, and you listen to what their routines are, it's very minimal, you know, and I think there's so much trust that they have because there's so much confidence in that ability, and that's pretty much what hitting is, you know. And yeah, I definitely think there's something is to that. You know, the more natural something is, the less you think about something, the more consistent you're going to be with it.
It's a great point. The less you think about it, the better off you are. Now, in terms of routine, before I let you go, in the offseason, JD Martinez posted a video of himself doing bench presses with 120-pound dumbbells. You responded with a video of yourself doing bench presses with 125-pound dumbbells, and honestly, you made it look pretty easy. Was that just a warning shot to him to step his game up, and did he respond?
That was more of just, you know, friends just poking fun at each other, really, you know. And it was close to spring, so he's like, "Oh, you know, a couple days till spring, step it up." So, like, I was with my friends, and we were just kind of, like, laughing at it. So I'm like, "Yeah, you know, I should do 125s and post it." "Oh, yeah, you should totally do that." So I did it. He saw it. He called me. We laughed about it, you know, just buddies poking fun at each other.
Got to do it. I'm not trying to make something out of nothing. Got to do it. And speaking of your offseason training, when you arrived at spring training, Brad Ausmus said he felt like you were faster on the base pass than you had been in the past. Was that maybe something he thought that he was seeing, or did you set out and actually work on that in the offseason?
No, I did, and it all started when I broke my hand, really. You know, it kind of clicked that your body doesn't last forever, so you want to take care of it so you can get the most out of it for as long as you can play. So I never really was a guy who really watched what I ate or took stretching and working out as seriously as I should. And it just clicked when I was sitting on the bench for those 50 games. So, you know, I changed my diet. I changed the way I went about training. And as a result, yeah, you know, I am a lot faster. I do feel quicker on the bases. No, I haven't been able to show that as much because I haven't been getting on base in the past, like, 2 weeks or so. But, I mean, that's all temporary, too. But when it does, you know, I feel good.
So what did you do to your diet? What did you do to change your diet, and was it hard in the beginning?
In the beginning it was, but then I realized it was just a decision. I'll never forget it. I was in Seattle, and it was probably the third game that that I wasn't playing, and there was a soft serve ice cream machine inside the clubhouse, which was phenomenal at the time. So, you know, I just made myself an ice cream cone, and everybody was getting ready to go out and play, and I'm sitting there with a cast on my hand eating ice cream, and I didn't really like the way that I felt about myself at that point in time, so I said, I'm done. And
I
stopped eating, bad food, really, and pretty much changed my diet. And I did it for one day, and then I did it the second day, and then the third day, and then pretty soon, before I knew it, that's just the way I ate.
I think that one-day thing is so key. You just get through the first day, and then you don't want to blow it. It's like you got some momentum and a streak, and you want to do it again. But I love that notion go ahead. Yeah.
It's just, at the end of the day, it's just a decision. Anything is really a decision. If you want to get in shape and you want to go work out, you know, you want to lose weight, you know, if you want to, whatever it is you want to do, it's a decision. Now you have to commit to that decision. But it starts with one, you know.
Makes
it all
you wonder,
started with throwing that ice cream cone away.
Yeah, Nick, it makes you wonder, though, right? It is just a decision. But if it's just a decision, it's that simple. Why do we make the wrong decision so often?
I think probably because it's easy and it's for self-convenience, you know? Temporary happiness, I feel like, is more appealing than the long-term decisions that you want to make. Because what's right isn't always easy, I think.
We know it's official because Tom Cruise went on a morning show, an Aussie morning show, and made the announcement. The host said on the way out, before I let you go, is there any update on Top Gun 2? Is it going to happen? Now, maybe she knew what he was going to say, or maybe not, but I've never heard anybody so excited about anything as she was when he dropped this on her.
Before we let you go, rumors of a Top Gun 2, please say it's true.
It's true.
Really?
Yeah, it's true.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
When? Tom!
It's true.
When?
It's true.
Are you allowed to say when? Can you give us a hint?
You know what? I'm going to start filming probably in the next
I think
next
now
year.
We know. Remember Becca, who won the spelling bee?
You
I think him. She grew up to be an Aussie television host.
Eve! Yeah!
T-O-P-G-U-N Top Gun!
It's true.
Really?
Now we know. This is a huge Top Gun house, and I hate the idea. Nobody needs Top Gun. Nobody wants Top Gun. Nobody I know. We don't need a wiser, more mature Mav. All right, I already mentioned there's no way ICE can pull this thing off. There's no way the military can build a jet big enough, fast enough, or strong enough to pull his fat ass through the air. All right, so now what about Mav? What about Mav? Cruise is money. I like Tom Cruise. I pay money to see Tom Cruise movies. I'll admit it. I'm not ashamed of it. Reacher, Hunt. I like these guys. And I know he'll go 100%, like he always does. He'll leave it all on the screen. It's not Cruise that I don't want to see. It's the character. Don't get that twisted. That's a key distinction. It's not Cruise that I don't want to see. It's Maverick. Last we heard, and I have no idea where they're going with this, but back in the day, last we heard, Mav was going to be an instructor. I hope they killed that idea. I hope that's not why they're bringing this thing back. Well, I hope they kill the entire notion of a sequel, but especially that part where Mav is an instructor. I mean, this guy's whole appeal is what? His whole appeal is he's Maverick, the rebel. He does not follow rules. That's what we like about Maverick. He does not follow rules. Now he's going to teach the rules? Can't do it. What's next? A Breakfast Club sequel where John Bender has cleaned up his act and now he's the high school principal?
You want another one?
I really don't want to see hotshot pilots getting screamed at by grumpy old Lieutenant Mitchell. I mean, again, what? Is Mav like the new Viper? The Tom Skerritt? And speaking of technology, I think we can all pretty much figure out exactly what the plot line's going to be. Obviously, they have to update and modernize their combat, meaning we're probably looking at unmanned aircraft. We're looking at drones. So let's just go ahead and take a wild, wild shot and see if we can get a missile lock on all of this? Let me guess. The Navy is phasing out dogfighting in favor of the new technology. The government believes there is no place for human pilots anymore. At least certainly no human pilot on a planet can outmaneuver a computer, right? We've seen this. We've seen this everywhere. At least that's what Maverick's being told. And then when it goes down, when the bleep really hits the fan, when drones are getting knocked right out of the sky, then it's time to take that new technology down. It's time to take that technology to school. It's time to take these drones to the bleeping danger zone.
Yeehaw!
Great balls of fire!
Great balls of
fire! What time is it? It's time to have sex with our instructors. It's time to kill our co-pilots and best friends. It's time to erase all memory of their existence by dropping down and chucking their dog tags. You see, I almost went for it. I almost got caught up. I almost talked myself into it. Man, I've got so much love for the original movie. So much nostalgia for that original movie. But then I remember, that was then and this is now. That was then and this is now. And now ice is fat. Goose is dead. The 80s are dead. So is Meg Ryan's face. Drones can't play beach volleyball. And I, for one, can't see this movie. I just can't. I can't. I won't. I can't. It stinks. It stinks. It stinks like Slider.
Slider, you stink.
So does the sequel. I'm just hoping that if I hit the brakes, this whole thing flies right by me.
But it hit the brakes, so fly right by.
This script should have a plaque for the alternates in the ladies' room.
The plaque for the alternates is down in the ladies' room.
Trust me, this can only end badly. It can only end badly. I'm not having anything to do with it. I'm not seeing it. Tim Beckham is my guest. Tim, it's great to have you on this show. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jim. How are you? Thanks
for
asking.
Good. Good to have you, Tim. Thanks so much. You dropped that game, Tim, to the Angels last
night. Jim, can you speak up a little? Jim, can you speak up a little bit?
Yeah, I got no problem with that. Can you hear me now?
All right, that's better. Yeah, that's
good.
Better,
you got it. You got it. So I was going to mention, Tim, you lost that game last night where you guys were trailing 2-0 in the bottom of the seventh. Logan Morrison doubled, and then you followed that up with a 7-pitch walk. Then Colby Rasmus hits one deep to right that looked like it was gone, but it hit the top of the wall. Everybody had to hold up and only advance one base. So what did you think when he made contact? Did you think that was a 3-run bomb?
Yeah, well, off the bat, man, I know me and Logan Morrison talked about it. We was anticipating he was either going to hang one and Colby would put a barrel on it somewhere, or he was going to spike one because he had the splitter going really well last night in the curveball. So when it came off the bat, I initially thought it was gone, but I was looking at Cole Calhoun. He looked like he had a beat on it, looked like he can make a play on it at the wall. So it was kind of a tough read. Would like to got one run out of that, but that's how the cookie crumbles sometimes.
That is how the cookie crumbles, and that's a game of inches, and it doesn't always go your way. Now, Tim, you go back to spring training, and there were people around the team who felt like you were primed for a big year. Did you have that same feeling in spring training yourself?
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously you want to take into spring training every year. You want to never lose confidence in yourself, and you always want to feel like this year is going to be the big year. And but, yeah, I was seeing the ball well. I was putting the barrel on pitches in the zone, and out, down, away. So, yeah, I felt like I didn't want to get ahead of myself, but I felt like I had a good year coming ahead, and I knew that I was going to get consistent at bats for the first time in the major league. So I knew I was – well, I'm not saying I was going to know, but I knew I was going to do some great things, man. It's going to help the club win some ball games.
Yeah, but it seems to me, Tim, that's such an important point that you just made. You knew you were going to get consistent at bats for the first time in the major leagues. I mean, it's not – it's tough when you're not getting that, because when you come in and you're not exactly sure who you're going to face or what you're going to do, how challenging is it when you're coming in and you're not getting the consistent at-bats and you've got to face closers or relief specialists?
Man, it's funny, man. I was talking to Ricky Weeks the other day and Peter Borgeson, just talking about some of the curveballs life can throw at you, man, and being a right-handed platoon player in the American League East is, so dude, you got to be a different type of animal, man, and you got to be ready to come off the bench in the ninth and face Zach Britton, and come off the bench in the ninth and face Andrew Miller and guys of that stature, and then when you get your start days, you're facing Chris Sale, you're facing David Price, and you're facing, I mean, like I said, you have to be a different animal, so it's a totally different mindset, man, and you just got to know that anytime you toe the box, that I'm gonna put together a good at bat, a quality at bat, and I'm gonna put the barrel on something, and on a quality pitch in the zone.
Tim Beckham joining us. I love that. I love that notion of a mindset too, because baseball is a game of up and downs, right? So you've had some challenging times, and you keep battling. In fact, one of the things I've heard you talk about is you have to embrace the struggle, because it's how you handle those down moments that speaks a lot about you. It's a great approach. So where did that approach come from?
Well, that approach, just going through struggles, man. Going through life struggles, going through baseball struggles, and just know that you're gonna come out on top. And I mean, I'm a big believer in prayer, and I got here through prayer, and I'm gonna make it through prayer. So, just embracing the struggle, and it's like I said earlier, man. It's a mindset. You got to be in that state of mind. You got to be a different animal to know that I can come out every day and. Even if you're not the best player in the world, you got to come out and look in the mirror, and I'm the best player in the world, and I'm ready to get out there every day. Every time I get in between the white lines, I put my spikes on, I'm ready to go.
I'm glad you brought that up, Tim. You put your spikes on every single day, because earlier this month, you broke out some sweet light blue high tops. Your manager, Kevin Cash, said that if you're going to do something like that, you better pull off that look. So what do? You go out, you hit a pair of two-out, two-run bombs during a 5-1 win. How satisfying was it to break out those kicks and then to back them up with a couple of bombs?
Oh, it's a good feeling, man. It's a good feeling anytime you connect for it. For a homer at any point in the game, but to hit two-run homers in a 5-1 ball game, and that means I helped my club win the ball game that night. So that's all you can ask for from any player on our team, and we just want to win games over here, man. We know we have a well put together lineup. We got a lot of athletic ability in our lineup, and we got a lot of pop in our lineup. So I think we can do some special things, and each night we come out, someone else contributes, and it's been fun so far. And we know we can play a lot better ball, and it's coming. It's definitely coming.
Ray, shortstop, Tim Beckham, my guest. You know, you spent some time yesterday visiting pediatric cancer patients at Tampa General Hospital. What did you take away from that experience?
Oh, man, it was great, man. It was great to see the kids and to see how positive they are. See how positive they are going throughout their days. And we all know that those kids, man, it's tough times in there. It's tough times in there. Some of those kids have been through 6 or 7 different surgeries, and they're battling. They're battling throughout life. And just to be able to go in there and spend an hour with those kids and to see the smiles on their faces and to see them brighten up when you walk in their hospital room is kind of touching, man. And it's definitely humbling. It's a humbling experience, and just to know someone that young has probably been through more tough times than you have throughout your life. So I'm blessed to be in the position I am, to be in there and going there and put smiles on those kids' faces, man, and brighten their day.
Now, I wonder, Tim, why kids that are that age that have gone through things that are much tougher than a lot of us will ever go through as adults can handle something like that with that kind of approach when we go through something that's not nearly as tough and our approach and reaction is so much worse. I mean, what can we learn from these kids?
That ties back to what we were saying earlier, man, just embracing the struggle, embracing life struggles, you know. You're going to go through a lot of ups and downs in life, and like I was telling one of the kids in the hospital yesterday, man, God built you to last, bro, and stay strong, keep a positive mindset, and God built his toughest battle for his strongest soldiers. So I firmly believe that, and like I said earlier, I was telling the kids, man, just keep going every day, keep fighting, man. We're all fighting battles, and we're all striving to be better people, and just keep going, bro, and keep praying about it, and every one of them, they'll make it through it.
Tim Beckham joining us. Tim, last thought. When you were young, you'd play ball with your older brothers, and now one of them, Jeremy, has opened up a Baseball Genius Academy, which not only teaches baseball skills, but also academics and test preparation. What kind of an impact did Jeremy have on you when you were young?
Oh, man, the impact my older brother had, I can't even put that into words right now. I probably wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for my older brother, because I veered off and I was playing basketball, I was playing football. I gave up baseball for like maybe 4 years, and but for him to stick with me, and he would drag me to the field and help him when he was, for me to just witness his work ethic at that young age, and for him to, I mean, coming out of Griffin, Georgia, wasn't any black athletes coming out of baseball, coming out of Griffin High School for baseball. So just to see his everyday grind and his everyday, just how he handled everything, as far as his routine and taking ground balls and running hills on his own and working out on going to the cages on his own when no one else is around. It taught me a lot. It taught me a lot about my work ethic, and to see him sign a Division I scholarship and to see him get drafted late in the 2004 draft is it was very special to me, and it opened my eyes and let me know that I could do some special things.
He was the first pick in the '08 draft out of Griffin High School in Georgia, Tampa Bay, 5.5 games out. There's shortstop Tim Beckham, my guest. Tim, that's great. I would say this, that the best kind of interviews are not interviews but conversations, and that's a really good interview, my man. I appreciate you, and I appreciate that, Tim. Great job.
Thank you, brother. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We go to Las Vegas. Cal in Vegas. It's good to have you, Cal. What's going on?
Hey, Jim. The other day you asked if one of the, quote, legends would call the show. Here I am. Here the bleep I am. The other day, that worthless crank Mark in Boston came in here talking trash about me. He said he swings lumber the size of a 2x4. It's more like a toothpick. Hey, everybody, look at me. I'm Mark in Boston. I got a Jim Harbaugh tattoo. Now I'm going to rip that tattoo off your arm and make you eat it. Jim, I didn't even come in here to beat up some broke stay-at-home dad. The reason I called, because I feel that I owe you an apology. I want to apologize for my little smack-off brother, Sad in L.A. Chad doesn't know his place in the world. He likes to come in here and go after guys that are much better than he is before he ultimately gets run. Chad, I know you're going to feel the need to respond to this. Don't even bother. You're not in my league, son. Just go hang out with your buddy Les in Laguna and tweak out somewhere. Jim, I don't even think that Chad will even show up to the smack-off this year. He doesn't have the mentality required. A few weeks ago, I had him fishhook so hard he was punching holes in the wall like Odell Beckham Jr. Chad, you said that you don't put me in your calls because it would hurt your brand. It's because your brand is acting and sounding just like me. Chad, you can't get with this. You ain't nothing but a Cal in Vegas wannabe. In the words of the late, great Dave in St. Louis, I'm going to make the world a better place by punching Chad right in the face. Man, why'd you start a fight with that little twerp Mark in Hollywood? Why don't you pick on someone your own size? Fat in L.A. stands 5 feet 11 inches, and he weighs 110 pounds. I didn't know that they stacked crap that high.
That's it? That's the call? Let's go to L.A. Chad, what's going on? How are you?
Hey, good, Rome. Hey, Cal, how many years in a row are you going to be on the watch list? You say I go after the legends to make a name for myself, but that's exactly what you just tried to do. Aside from Jeff Passan, nobody else is low enough to crack back on you. So I asked Cal to come in and help me smash Cal.
Cal, you're an idiot and a buffoon. You sound like you're constipated. That was for you, Cal.
There you go, Chad in L.A. That was quick. Once again, thank you very much for listening. I appreciate it so much. Once again, thank you very much for listening. You know, I appreciate you. Hit subscribe, tell a friend, trust that podcast, and check back tomorrow for more Daily Jungle.
Really?